I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri voters will see three statewide propositions on ballots this fall. One of them, Proposition D, would have people who buy gas here paying 10 cents more per gallon over the next 4 years. Today we'll hear Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe's pitch for why voters should approve the proposal, and we'll ask why it also includes a sales tax exemption for Olympic athletes. Then, teachers in the U.S. are more segregated than their students, a report from the Brookings Institution has found. We'll find out how that's happened, how to change it, and learn how a more diverse teaching staff stands to benefit white and minority students. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. On the ballot this November in Missouri will be a question about raising the gasoline tax by a dime over several years. The argument is that the increase is badly needed. The tax today is 17 cents a gallon, a number that hasn't budged since 1994. Missouri today has the second lowest fuel tax in the entire country, trailing only Alaska, and it has the seventh largest highway network anywhere in the nation. But is the gas tax regressive? That is, does it hurt the poor? Also, is the tax a big enough boost? And is the state thinking outside the box enough? Here to talk about this fuel tax increase, known as Prop D, is Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe, who's been touring the state of late, touting this gas tax. And Governor, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you're out pushing this fuel tax increase known as Prop D. Why is it needed, and what's your pitch?
Well, it's been 22 years, Steve, since we've had an increase in the gas tax. Mm-hmm. And in those 22 years, whether you're running a family budget or a business budget or a municipal budget, you know that costs have gone up in those 22 years. Our road system is the seventh largest in the United States. We are about 44th in funding by the same measurement of center lane per mile. We're about 49th in our amount of gas tax. So to maintain our roads, to keep them safe and reliable for economic development reasons, we need to find a way to fund our highways. We're at about half of what we were in the late 2005 to 10 period as far as a construction budget for MoDOT, about what we had back then. So we've been getting by. MoDOT has been tightening their belt. They've done some reorganization in the last several years to their organization to right-size their workforce and do the best they can to keep as many dollars on the roads as possible. But we're still short of what we need to, you know, have more of a robust program to keep our highways in the shape that Missourians deserve.
So if we don't pass it then, what happens?
Well, you're going to continue to see we kind of are doing a Band-Aid approach right now. We have about 920 bridges that are of concern to MoDOT right now out of our 10,400. And then if you add the bridges that are owned by cities and counties across the state, in addition to those MoDOT bridges, it's about 2,100 bridges that are deficient in the measuring of an engineer. You know, those are bridges that our school buses and ambulances and families drive across. And right now, that number is growing by about 100 a year. So we're not catching up in the current budget with the availability to keep our bridges in safe shape. So if we do not pass this, bridges are just one example, but bridges and roadways just do not have enough money to maintain the entire system. And so then you go on priorities. You try to maintain the ones where the traffic is the most and the people that, the reliable roads that folks are trying to use. And then there's some roads that just don't make the list.
Yeah.
We would like to get this passed so we'd have an opportunity for those communities to decide if their roads are the ones that should be able to get paved or bridges rebuilt. And we think Proposition D will go a long way in helping us get there.
Some of the money that would be part of this increase will go back to local governments. Mike, tell us about that.
That's correct. Currently, right now, 70% of the 17 cent we collect goes to MoDOT for in a constitutionally protected, constitutionally directed pot of money that cannot be messed with by politicians or engineers, I might add. So 70% goes into that pot, and then 30% goes to cities and counties. It would be the same way with this increase, which the proposal is 2.5 cents a year for 4 years. So after fully implemented, it would be 10 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So 30% of that total amount will end up going back to cities and counties, and they are in the same shape MoDOT is. Their costs have been going up. They're not able to keep up with their maintenance of their facilities and assets of roads and bridges in their areas. So they're very much in support of this as well, so that they can take care of the, you know, the municipal and county-owned structures.
And there's also some of this money, Governor, will go to law enforcement. Explain that to us.
Sure. That's a little bit of the complicated part that just takes a second, so if you don't mind. The pot of money I talked about that's constitutionally protected, the state road fund that comes, that is funded by our gas tax, that can serve for primarily two purposes of distribution. One is to build a road or bridge. The other one is to fund the enforcement cost of our highways to Missouri State Highway Patrol. And the Constitution directs the word shall. So it says we shall pay the Highway Patrol out of that pot of money to enforce our highways. They are currently getting funded. About two-thirds of their funding comes through that revenue source. The other third is their, you know, Marine Patrol and Crime Lab, et cetera. So about two-thirds of the Highway Patrol's budget is what it takes to maintain the safety on our highways, and it comes out of that same pot. What we're proposing is putting more money in that pot that helps us provide the funding and have enough to fund the Highway Patrol and leave the money they are getting now for roads and bridges.
I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned we haven't had a fuel tax increase in this state, Mike, since 1994. Should the state add an inflation, you know, index to its fuel fund so the tax can somehow keep up with inflation?
You know, in a perfect world, if we would have done that back in the 90s,
we wouldn't be having this conversation today, right?
About this very subject right now.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, you try to put through the legislature the best package, the best proposal you can get. I will tell you that the 9 months of 2017, there was a 21st century task force that was made up of House and Senate members, community members, people that are interested in transportation that went all over the state of Missouri and literally had hundreds of meetings. It was led in the House by your own Kevin Corlew,
right?
By the way, and Dave Schatz in the Senate, and they met with Missourians all over the place, every place you can imagine, to try to find out what's acceptable, what would be reasonable way to take care of our transportation system. You know, Steve, I've been, as you know, on the Highway and Transportation Commission before I was in the Senate, and then since I've been in the Senate. So in the 13, 14 years I've been talking about this, I find most Missourians understand we have a funding gap. What they don't kind of coalesce behind is an exact way they like to fix it. And so this is the best kind of path that we could find that kind of took that balanced approach between the various ideas. Indexing, to your point, was certainly one of them. Sales tax, we tried back in 14, as you recall, and it failed, quite frankly, miserably.
Yes.
Missouri's not ready for toll roads yet, and that's only a corridor fix, even when you do have them. So when you look at the three or four different ways of funding highways, it seems like, according to Missourians, this would be the one that not everybody likes, of course, but this would be the one that had the best chance to succeed.
You know, I can't help but wonder, why does Missouri have one of the lowest gasoline taxes in the entire nation? I mean, how did that happen, Mike? I guess what I'm wondering is, why is the General Assembly so resistant to providing a fuel tax that is at least an average fuel tax across the country and would help the state offer a more, you know, robust transportation network?
Well, some people may or may not agree with the Hancock provision in our Constitution, but I usually tell people, thank goodness we have the Hancock provision that prevents, and what this question going to the ballot means, the Hancock provision is working. It prevents lawmakers from making substantial tax increases onto our Missouri citizens, and something like this has to go before the vote of the people. This tax, it would go about $288 million, a year into MoDOT once fully implemented, and $124 million a year to cities and counties. So it's a 400 and over $400 million increase in road and bridge funding for state and cities and counties. That number is, as you know, from the Hancock provision, that is, you know, triple or four or five times more right. than what the legislature could put past. So because of that provision, we need to make sure this goes before voters. In other states, Steve, I would say, don't either have that or they looked at other methods of funding their transportation system that they've been able to work with on their voters. So other states have been able to do it, but quite frankly, lots of states are in a predicament because the cost of construction, the cost to maintain highways has just gone up significantly in the last couple of decades. And so a lot of states are behind the eight ball in funding.
You know, I want to talk about these other methods in just a moment. But first, another question that sort of, I think, is pressing here. Is 10 cents a gallon over the next several years, is that enough, Governor? Is that enough to make the kind of difference that you think needs to be made, again, given your experience on the Highway Commission going back several years?
Yeah, it's an incremental approach. It is not it does not solve every one of Missouri's problem. But in Missouri, we are the show me state, and I think we have to show our citizens. MoDOT is going to have to show their citizens, and the cities and counties who get their portion are going to have to show their constituents what they're able to do with the money. And if there's another conversation several years from now, that would have to be yet determined. I will tell you from the MoDOT standpoint, we have some light at the end of the tunnel. It just doesn't happen for 8 or 9 years in that as you remember, Amendment 3 from back in 2004, which required highway projects to be bonded, and we did some large projects across the state. I remember specifically the Paseo Bridge in your area and the Grandview Triangle. Those are projects that came when we had that. Those bonds are going to be retiring in the 25, 26, 27 years. And so if we can get Proposition D pass, we believe it will also help the Highway Department get back to that revenue stream when those bonds are retiring. So it's not probably the perfect answer, but again, it's the incremental answer. It's the answer it seemed like Missourians would accept. As that 21st Century Task Force had those meetings.
Missouri Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe is my guest. We're talking about Proposition D in Missouri this November. It would raise the gasoline tax by a dime over several years. You know, one of the criticisms of the fuel tax is that any increase, you know, hits the poor the hardest. It's a regressive tax. What would be a way around that, Mike?
Well, there's, like I say, you know, we heard that same conversation when we talked about the sales tax, because no matter what your income stream is, you're likely buying something that you pay sales tax on. So the thing about the gas tax, Steve, that I think Missourians should remember is about 35% of our gas tax and diesel tax is paid by non-Missouri residents.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're talking about something that affects the poor, at least this particular project, so these sets of projects and this income stream, is literally supplemented by visitors and other companies that are coming through the state. And it seems to be the most fair. And even the poorest of poor, believe me, I grew up in North City, St. Louis. I have literally been there. They still rely on an ambulance to get to their house. They still rely on school buses for their kids. They still rely on goods and services to get to the places they need where they're trying to buy food and groceries for their family. And so the transportation system provides those opportunities for those folks. It needs to be robust so they can depend on it.
You know, another criticism aimed at this issue is that we're not thinking enough outside the box here, that we should be taking different approaches, I guess. You know, one of those you've mentioned here today, Mike, it's a toll along I-70. Governor Nixon was at least taking a peek at that idea. Another idea might be, you know, heavier registration, the taxes on more expensive vehicles. Any thoughts on other kinds of approaches we should be thinking about here?
Sure. Well, you know, 36 other states use tolling as a form to pay for a corridor. Tolling will not pay for a statewide transportation system. It typically provides enough funding to repair a corridor, take care of a corridor. My first 2 years in the Senate, I sponsored legislation that would allow Missouri to consider toll roads. I joke, this is not serious. That was the only 2 years where I had almost death threats for legislation. That was a joke. And the reason is, it's because people are very passionate about the I-70 corridor. 60% of our population lives either 30 miles north or 30 miles south of I-70. And so when you look at that corridor between St. Louis and Kansas City, it's just very important to our state and to our economy. You have a lot of people who are emotionally tied to what that might mean if you want to a system with a public-private partnership or something that required tolls. And it's a very, very, very very hard conversation, even with modern tolling technology that would probably not be as onerous as most people think.
You can drive right through without slowing down, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's all high-speed license plate capture, et cetera. It's a tough conversation to have. It's something that has to be left on the table for the future, but right now Missourians just are not ready to embrace that concept.
You know, I-70, though, is a mess, and I think you might agree with that. You know, we've been talking about the need to rebuild I-70 for years and years now, and yet you don't see that conversation going anywhere. What is the future for rebuilding I-70?
Well, again, I think that as we look at the retirement of bonds from Amendment 3, the 2004 bonding measure that we'll see happening in the next several years, MoDOT will be able to look at a revenue stream for that. Certainly when you have something like Proposition D, right now we spend about $90 million a year maintaining I-70 in the current condition it is. It's just too old of a roadbed that was compacted with old technology 60 years ago for traffic counts that are half that's on there. When we look at that, trying to think outside the box, I think when you have something like Proposition D pass, you're able to start looking at options for projects like I-70. And I don't want anybody listening to think this means I-70 gets fixed, but at least it leaves options. And quickly, I will tell you that we're also eyeing what the federal government is going to do with any of their infrastructure programs that might come out of Washington, D.C. And right now, we have an 80-20 match with the feds on a project like I-70, 20% from the state. We're relatively sure the federal government will change that and will be more of a match for states to pay.
Right.
But the good news is the pot of money that's successful will be higher. So when you have something like Proposition D, you have the resources to make a little bit higher federal match for a project like I-70. No guarantees, but you have the ability to get there. And then maybe the revenue stream can come that would help us fix that interstate in that scenario. So it does leave some options for us on the table for funding and match funding for a project like 70 that we simply do not have today.
I'm talking with Mike Kehoe. He's the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Missouri about the state's gasoline tax. You know, the way this Prop D is written, Mike, it's not only a gas tax increase, it also includes a tax exemption for Olympic athletes, and it creates a fund for projects to improve roads and alleviate bottleneck traffic. Why have those exceptions built into this thing, and why Olympic athletes?
Well, we got to the point in the legislative session, you've been around politics so long, you understand this, where when we finally got consensus from the House and Senate to move this question forward, the only bill that was out there that where the title fit was Representative Evans' bill out of St. Louis that had to deal with taxation, and that title was the right title to be able to put this language on. That's a simple bill that everybody was coalescing behind. She was nice enough to allow us to use that bill because she believes in the infrastructure fix. That's a very no-brainer question. If a Missouri resident were to get an Olympic medal, should they be taxed on the gift of that medal? And I think most Missourians would agree they should not be. So that is the underlying bill, so that obviously had to stay there. The bottleneck fund was a piece that we needed to move through the legislature to get basically urban areas on board where they might have a bottleneck in your area that could be. I'm not saying it is, but it could be 435 and 70 in the St. Louis area. It could be I-64 and 70. So it makes those bottleneck issues available, not necessarily earmarked money in this project for no shape or form, but it does make those projects available to be considered should those regions, Mark, in your area as your planning partner, decide that's something they want to spend the money on.
Governor Parsons on board with Prop D?
Yes, sir, very much. He has been very supportive of trying to figure out ways to fund our infrastructure system. The priorities of his administration are workforce development, which is something we're working very hard on every day right now, and then infrastructure in general, and certainly highways and bridges are one of those. And it's not normal for two Republicans at the top of the House to come out with something like this, but
right.
I think Missourians are a little bit tired of politics as usual. This is just something that's needed. We have to talk about it. Missourians will decide. But I think not talking about it, not bringing it forward, is not the right thing to do, and neither does Governor Parson.
Now, I just have you for a few more minutes, Governor. I wanted to ask you about the transition that you and Governor Parson have made in the last few months as you've taken over after Governor Greitens resigned. You had been the Senate Majority Leader, so you were obviously familiar with state government. What's been the toughest part of this process for you as you've moved from leading the state Senate to serving as Lieutenant Governor?
Well, you know, mentally, I was ready to go back in the private sector starting in January of 19. So I had started to make moves figuring out what that next chapter of our family's life was like. But other than that, you know, it's just more, it's obviously more travel, I think, to be a good statewide official. And I think all of our statewides, Democrat or Republican, it doesn't matter, do a good job of getting out and about and listening to Missourians, finding out what their needs are, making sure we stay out of their way when possible, and then helping them when needed. So it's a little bit more travel. My wife and I are now finally empty nesters of four children, so yeah. It does allow me to get out and about around the state. And it's a very, I will tell you, it's a very humbling position that the governor would ask me to do, but also I love the state of Missouri, and I love the people who work here and live here, and so I'm happy to try to help them if I can.
You know, people always wonder, Mike, what does the lieutenant governor do?
I hear that every day.
I bet you do.
My mother asked me that when I told her Governor Parson was asking me to do this. So
what is that job, son?
91 years old, she's still pretty sharp as well.
Yeah.
So constitutionally, we preside over the Senate. We're there in a chance of a tie vote. And then by statute, we are very involved with the Veterans Commission and our veterans' homes and veterans' opportunities across the state. We're very involved in tourism and have a seat on the tourism board. And then we also, Governor Parson, as lieutenant governor, started the Buy Missouri program. So the lieutenant governor's office has the Buy Missouri, which just brings awareness to Missourians about products that are made in our state and the families and employees who make those. So that's our primary job. Right now we're talking about infrastructure, so We have a pretty full plate at the lieutenant governor's office.
So no question there's enough for you to do these days.
Yes, sir. There's enough for us to do these days. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Why did you want to serve in public in the state Senate to begin with, Mike? What drew you to that?
Well, I was on the Highway Commission, as you know, from 05 to 10, an appointment of then-Governor Blunt, and I became very interested in our infrastructure system, to be honest with you. And a small businessman and the father of four, I also was a little bit concerned about what decisions were being made in the Capitol. A very good friend of mine, Carl Vogel, who was our state senator, right, was term limited out, and there was an opportunity there. So I thought that I could, you know, represent small business, represent what families are interested in by being having a large family, and also try to advance the infrastructure conversation, which I've worked on ever since I've been there. So that's pretty much what drew me to that part of the public service.
Now, just a final question today, Governor. I sure appreciate your time. We began the show today by talking about the legal fight over the Clean Missouri ballot initiative, also slated to be on the ballot in November, along with the gasoline tax. Oh, this is aimed at cleaning up state government. It's seen as an ethics proposal. Where do you come down on it?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I worked with Justin Offerman in the House to sponsor gift ban language in the Senate. We never really got it moved very far. It came through my committee. So I am 100% on board with trying to rework some of our ethics procedures in the Capitol and gift ban, et cetera. I voted for the revolving door, which now does have a ban on legislators coming back to practice as lobbyists. Maybe it's not long enough or good enough, but, Steve, it's different than we had just 2 or 3 years ago. I have big concern in Clean, though, with the piece of the redistricting. Mm-hmm. I think the redistricting process now works well. It's made up of Democrats and Republican lawmakers. When times it gets challenged, it goes through the court system. And I really get concerned if you have the state demographer and the Clean question moves forward, that we literally could have districts that combine Jackson County with, you know, with Christian County, or districts that aren't contiguous that have different needs and different matters, and make it very hard for people to represent those districts. So,
but why wouldn't it be better than having lawmakers do it?
Redistricting piece.
Mike, why wouldn't it be better than having lawmakers themselves draw their own districts?
Well, because lawmakers are elected by people. So, I mean, their constituents are going to hold them accountable for those decisions they made, just like any other decision they make in the Capitol. And so I think they have to represent what their constituents want. And the people that are on those redistricting border, or, you know, border committees, I've never been on one. I was in the Senate when we redrew the lines, you know, back in 11 and 12, I believe it was, after the census. I just think that process works. And I think it reflects districts that are more consistent with what one person can represent for the values within that district.
Okay, that's Missouri Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe talking about the need for a new gasoline tax increase in Missouri. Governor, I sure appreciate your time. Thanks very much for taking it with us.
Thanks for having me on. I'm happy to come back at any time.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about why teachers are so segregated. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on this program, revitalizing the Truce Corridor, an area near 31st Street is being redeveloped. But how will that affect those living in the area? Find out at kcur.org/up-to-date. You've seen her on The Office and in Bridesmaids and 21 Jump Street. Now hear her on Up to Date. Next week, we'll speak with actor and author Ellie Kemper about her transition from Missouri to Hollywood. Join us for that show on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, here's an idea for you. Teachers in the U.S. are even more segregated than their students. That's a surprising finding, given that teachers are thought to have more latitude in choosing where they work. So what's going on out there, and what's the impact on students? Turns out that there's a range of positive outcomes for students of color when there's greater teacher diversity, and maybe for white kids, too. The benefits include not just test scores, but an impact on disciplinary actions and teacher expectations. Now a conversation about our segregated teacher ranks. With us, Michael Hansen is director of the Brown Center on Education Policy and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Mike, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me here, Steve.
Tamika Chester is a partner at Kansas City Plus. That's a two-year master's program that helps educators become school leaders. Tamika, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, explain this to us, Mike. How can it be that our teacher ranks are so segregated?
Well, this is a really good question, and I think the place to start here would be looking at teacher segregation through a historical lens. Before Brown versus Board of Education, particularly in the South, we had predominantly segregated schools, so schools for black kids and schools for white kids, but then with the order to integrate, once that Supreme Court decision was made, students, white students and white and black students started going to the same schools. However, there was a decision that was made that black teachers really couldn't teach white students. And so it wasn't necessarily an official declaration, but it just sort of came down the line that many black teachers lost jobs in the wake of that decision. And so when that began to happen, teaching historically had been seen as a good, productive entry into the middle class for black families. However, when many teachers lost their jobs, so an estimated one-third of the black teacher workforce at the time eventually lost their jobs after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, and it sort of has impacted the attractiveness of the teaching profession for people who are college students who are going to school, who are trying to decide a major. Many of them are now choosing not to go into education as a result. You know, this is, of course, generations later
right.
now.
I was going to say, so your point is that this goes back years, decades, the reason for this segregation among teachers.
Yeah, that's right. It has its historical roots, and from that time, people have alerted signals, we need to do better at recruiting minority teachers, but it's been hard, and primarily the places that have made an active effort to recruit minority teachers are places that serve large numbers of students of color. So as a result, they tend to be attracted and clustered in schools that already have high shares of minority students. And so, and then also there is some evidence that there are perhaps more covert ways of shuffling teachers of color into schools that serve high numbers of students of color that have happened, you know, looking at resumes and likelihood of getting job placements. And so through a number of factors, it just appears that teachers of color are disproportionately teaching in places where students of color are. Hmm. And if you actually look at how, and sort of the interesting thing is that students of color are now actually getting more diffuse over time, but we don't actually see that happening on the teacher side,
That's interesting. Yet. Tamika Chester, again, with Kansas City Plus. To what extent do you see this problem here in Kansas City?
It mirrors what we see nationally. Part of the reason Kansas City Plus exists is because, as Michael said, we know that the racial disparity between students of color and the teacher and leader workforce is large, and it continues to grow. And this is where alternative certification and credentialing programs like Kansas City Pathway to Leadership in Urban Schools come into play.
That's what Kansas City Plus stands for. That's the acronym you just explained to us.
Yeah. Yes.
Hey, how does it work, what you guys do?
So Kansas City Plus is a part of a national network of Plus programs that was started in 2013 by TNTP, which is a national nonprofit focusing on increasing educational equity in mm-hmm. all phases of education. And what we saw in our work as a national organization around teacher development, we saw that there was a need to increase and diversify the teaching workforce, a need to increase school leaders who could support and retain teachers. So in our program, we provide a pathway, a lower cost pathway to becoming a teacher, to becoming a leader. And so people spend about 2 years in our program. They earn a master's degree, and they are working in schools across Kansas City. So they're not just working in urban schools where the majority population of students are students of color. They're working in the suburbs, they're working in parochial schools, working in private schools.
These are teachers of color who become leaders in their schools you're talking about.
Yes.
You know, I read a report out of Brookings, Tamika, that suggested that both white and non-white teachers report higher job satisfaction and there's less turnover when their principal is of the same race. Why would that be?
You know, Steve, I don't know that there's one answer for why that might be. What we do know, and oftentimes where there is a teacher of color and they are the lone teacher of color, there's an effect that former Secretary of Education John King described as the invisible tax or the invisible burden. And so what often happens when they are the lone teacher or one of very few, they are responsible for being the relationship builder, being the person who understands all the challenges of the students of color in that building. This shows up, for example, if you have one.
It's a heavy burden on them, you're describing.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a psychological tax, and it makes it difficult, just like we see with our students. Students report greater relationship, greater investment on the behalf of their teachers when there is someone who looks like them. I'd love to, if I have a moment, to share a story on our blog.
I think I know what story you're going to share, and I really was drawn to it. Yeah.
We shared a story about a young Mexican-American male named Jose who spent the first 10 years of his K-12 education without ever having seen a male teacher of color. Imagine that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Jose's desire was to be a teacher. So you can imagine the psychological impact when you want to be in a profession and you have no examples of anyone who looks like you.
We have a caller here I'm going to bring into our conversation who I think wants to make a very similar point that Tamika just made. Edgar from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air. We're talking this morning about teacher segregation in Kansas City and across the country. Edgar, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to quickly just say how incredibly thankful I am that you're having this conversation, because across the country, 8% of educators identify as Latinx, and then an incoming 25% of the kindergarten population identifies Latinx. So there's a huge disparity there, which ultimately impacts educational outcome.
You know, Edgar, hang on a second. Tamika, his line's a little bit breaking up a little bit. Explain to us what he's saying so we have a sense of that.
So what I think Edgar is, he's talking about the disparity. So we know only 18% of our entire teaching workforce are teachers of color. And this is Black, Latinx, Asian. So when you think
18% nationally, and that would compare to what would be the corresponding percentage of the population that is comprised of people of color like that, you know, off the top of your head?
I don't know.
Off the top. Yeah, go ahead then. Yeah.
Just to intervene.
Yeah, Mike.
In the state of Kansas, about 8.8% of teachers in Kansas are teachers of color, and in Missouri, it's 9% of teachers.
And that would be far less than the actual percentage of people of color in both those states. Do I have that right, Mike?
Yeah, that's right. The student population is 32% students of color in Kansas and 27% in Missouri. I don't know the breakdown of Latinx, as Edgar mentions, but yes, there is a stark contrast there.
I was going to say, Mike, that those are huge disparities we're looking at there, right?
Yeah, so about triple the number of students as a proportion versus what you have among teachers.
Yeah, Tamika, go ahead. Yeah.
And this is why alternative certification and access pipeline programs exist like PLUS. Across all of our PLUS programs nationally, 60% of our candidates represent or identify as people of color. Here in Kansas City, 51% of our total program participants identify as people of color.
Yeah. You know, Mike, you say in your report that there's this range of benefits from student outcomes to test scores to disciplinary actions to teacher expectations. I wonder if we could take these one at a time and get you to comment on, again, the benefit from having more teachers of color for many students. What's the impact on student outcomes here?
Well, let me first just preface this by saying that the research that I'm about to describe, it doesn't allege that white teachers are necessarily advancing white students because they prefer them by any means. There are many teachers who are serving diverse populations who have a real interest in trying to promote their long-term well-being. Mm-hmm. And so I don't believe that any of these are nefarious racist attitudes at all, but rather there's just a lot of psychological research that talks about unconscious bias and how we tend to prefer in groups, or we tend to treat people within our who share a similar background in different ways because we know better how to contextualize that information rather than somebody who is not part of our in-group. And so for example, we've seen studies where teachers would see similar behavior among kids. So looking at, for example, preschoolers who are playing, and some preschoolers, they may have more aggressive behavior. They begin to act out a little bit. If the preschooler is a preschooler of color, and if the teacher is white, that teacher is more likely to perceive that behavior as problematic, something mm-hmm. where they intervene. Whereas if that teacher is a teacher of color, she looks at it as a situation that she may perhaps need to monitor, maybe need to intervene to help de-escalate, but not necessarily need to refer and get the principal in. And so there are these subtle differences that do spell different consequences. Another example is looking at like students' likelihood of getting into advanced courses or gifted and talented types of programs.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the margin, white teachers are much more likely to recommend white students to gifted and talented programs. Now, of course, white students in general, they are coming from higher socioeconomic status backgrounds, and they tend to score higher on their test scores already. And so in that sense, we expect a disproportionate number of them to get into gifted and talented programs. But whenever teachers of color are in their classrooms, they look at different factors and whether a student of color is ready for the advanced coursework, and they are more likely to put students of color in.
So what you're about to describe then are the benefits when a teacher of color is teaching students of color. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. So in general, we see small matching effects is what we've termed them within the research literature. But yes, we see small matching effects. Usually it's on the order of a couple of percentage points. These matching effects, they're not closing achievement gaps by any means, but they do make a difference. And they have been associated with things like high school increased likelihood of high school graduation and your likelihood mm-hmm. of enrolling in college. As I mentioned, the exclusionary discipline, like student suspensions. We also have the gifted and talented. We also have increased documentation of increased teacher expectations if their teacher is the same racial background as the students are. Expectations of how they'll perform and whether they'll do well in high school or college.
Right, right.
And so we've seen a number of these outcomes.
Tamika, there's a video that you guys show that maybe makes this point. Are you with me on that? Can you describe what that is? Isn't there some video online that talks about a student who's been able to relate to a teacher of the same color as he is? Is this ringing a bell?
No.
No. Okay. How about this notion of how students internalize these perceptions that Mike is describing here when a teacher who might be white takes a different approach to disciplinary action than a teacher of color might?
So I think we see this internalized. To Mike's point, let's take, for example, we know that students, when they have a teacher of color, are less likely to be suspended. So and we know that nationally, males of color are suspended at significantly higher rates. So it creates a real system of internalized oppression. Kids don't have the opportunity to see themselves in the teacher. So they may not engage. They may not mm-hmm. ask questions in a classroom. They may not share the challenges because they are perceiving that teachers already have these baked-in notions. They may opt out of programs, or they may... because no one wants to put themselves at risk. I can even think about when I started my teaching career about 20 years ago. In the first school I had the privilege of teaching, I was the lone teacher of color. And every single time there were students of color who had any behavioral concern or mm-hmm. issue, they were always referred and sent to my class. And so what that said to the student, and I had students tell me this, so-and-so teacher doesn't like me, I'm a bad kid, or you're the only person in this school I can believe that believes in me. Imagine that. You spend 900 to 1300 hours a year in school and you believe Dr. Chester is the only teacher that cares about you. And that created such a burden on me. I didn't, one, as a 21-year-old, I didn't know how mm-hmm. to deal with every single challenge. And so I just share that as an example. People, it's not just about having diverse teachers, but it's about the inclusive culture that mm-hmm. must come with diversity, the inclusive culture that allows us to ask ourselves deep questions about what does it really mean to feel valued and welcomed, and what is the lived experience in the school of the students. And I think if we ask ourselves those questions, like what are our kids experiencing day to day, we would see changes in who's in front of our kids.
The tough part of this conversation, though, Tamika, is I really get the impression after hearing Mike describe the numbers of teachers in both states, we've got a long, long, long way to go here before the kind of diversity in the teacher ranks is going to reach what you might hope it should think it should be.
We do have a long way to go. But there are some positive moves to help us get there. So one of the things that TNTP, my organization, found is that almost 3/4 of teacher candidates in traditional education preparation programs are white. And when we think about the financial barriers and costs to even becoming a teacher, it costs upwards of $20,000 typically for tuition and testing fees. And so this is where alternative certification programs, where you see greater numbers of diverse teachers entering in the profession, because through those alternative certification and alternative development programs, some of those financial barriers have been eliminated and alleviated.
Let me go back and try Edgar one more time here. I was calling back and talk about the impact on Latinos in connection with the teaching ranks. Edgar, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
I think you sound a little better.
Fantastic. Now, I want to echo and reinforce Tamika's point on the importance of inclusivity and cultural competency in the school systems where our educators of color are working in. Recruitment is definitely a part of the solution, but so is retention. And so we have to make sure that we create culturally competent environments that support Latinx educators so they can stick around and continue to educate our students.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Tamika, what are the most effective things a school district can do to increase teacher diversity? I mean, does the best solution come from the district level, or is it a school-to-school problem? Because Edgar is right. The research says retention is a huge deal here.
It's an everybody problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at the state and district level, we can start to look at what are the policies and practices structurally that are in place that bar. So we can look at our state testing requirements for teachers, our credentialing requirements. At the school level, we can start to ask questions. Does the teaching population here at this school mirror the communities we serve? Why or why not? What biases, unconscious or conscious, may be at play? We can ask students of color, how are you experiencing school? School mm-hmm. leaders can, to Edgar's point, have curriculum, make curriculum choices and train their staff in how to be more culturally responsive so that both teachers and students see the school experience as a mirror to themselves and a window into other cultures. When there are teachers of color in schools, school principals, and I'm a former school principal, we can have those conversations one-to-one to say, how are you experiencing mm-hmm. this school? I want you to stay. We can also, when we know that we have staff members, and this is true of any teachers that are strong, effective teachers that we want to retain, giving them opportunities to lead and serve, telling them the value, engaging them in the process. So one large part of our program in Kansas City Plus, as I shared, right now, 51% of our participants identify as people of color. Mm-hmm. A large number of our participants or our candidates, excuse me, we get from referrals. So we're asking candidates of color who are having a positive experience, share this within your network. We partner with local universities. We go to community organizations. We spread the word that here's a pathway for you that you may not have known about and considered.
We're going to have to leave our conversation right there. That was the voice of Tamika Chester. She's a partner at Kansas City Plus. That's a 2-year master's program that helps educators become school leaders. Tamika, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Mike Hansen is director of the Brown Center on Education Policy and a senior fellow out of the Brookings Institution. Mike, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Steve.
Next week on the show, can someone accused of sexual assault sit on the nation's highest court? We'll be asking you that question on KCUR's Up to Date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Jean-Vieve Desmarteau, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.